Well, good morning, church. As Tommy said, we're doing things a little bit differently this morning, but it's still a great time to be gathered together for worship, a great time to be gathered around the table that we're going to do very shortly. I tell you, from my perspective, it's tough to be a much better time. Yesterday, we had a very exciting day. Rosa Qualls was baptized. If you don't know Rosa, that's her in the blue shirt and sitting right back there. That she has a speech she wants to give, but I told her, no, Rosa, you cannot stand up. But y'all give Rosa a hand. She has been here every time the door's been open for the last few months, and it was a very, very powerful time yesterday. And you can tell that becoming a Christian meant a lot to her. And so I'm so thankful that I got to just be there and be a part of that. Now, how many of you are familiar with this painting right here? Raise your hand if you've ever seen this one. You ever seen this one? Who can tell me what it's named? What's the name of it? Last Supper. That's right. Now, who can tell me who painted this famous painting? Da Vinci. That's right. Before he wrote the Da Vinci Code, he painted this painting. Lesser known history. Anyway, this particular painting was completed in 1498. It was painted as a mural, like so on the wall, of the convent Santa Maria del Grazie in Milan, Italy. It's now a museum, but it was a mural that was painted along the wall of the refectory, like the dining hall. Great big mural covered this dining hall. What you may not know is that the painting has been so degraded and it's been retouched a number of times because it's painted on a wall and moisture gets on those walls and things have changed with those walls. So this is not the original. This is the original. So what you may not be able to tell is there's no feet of Jesus here because they decided they needed to put a door right there. So this is the arch of a doorway that comes up. And so for many, many years, we didn't know what the feet of Jesus looked like, right? Because based on this painting, he didn't have any feet. So we weren't sure. Thankfully, it was, even though this original has deteriorated, it's been retouched a number of times. But how do they do retouches unless we have the copies? So the image that we most often see and think of as the Last Supper was not actually painted by Da Vinci. There were a few copies that were done by his apprentices, his students. The original was painted in 1498. Around 1515 to 1520, there were a few copies that were done. The most famous, the most well done was, or the one that's considered the best done, is in the Royal Academy of Arts in London. But there are other very famous copies of the painting. So as a result, what has happened is we've taken the copies and we looked and we're like, oh, that's what Jesus' feet looked like. And that's what, I mean, not the original, but you know what I'm saying. And there are other details that are so faded from the original, you had to look at the copies to make the touch-ups because you can't see what the hands are doing or what the gestures are, or the facial expressions, just the little things that are in the original that have been lost over the years. All the details, we've got to get all the details from the copies. Kind of fascinating, isn't it? Well, one of the regular practices that we partake in every Sunday, this church, is we partake of the Lord's Supper. And I remember as a kid, I was telling this story earlier this week, and these trays that we have, these are lighter. I mean, they're pretty light. They're pretty easy to hold. That was not the case with the church that I grew up. They were made of lead. And I mean, they were so heavy. And they did not have little plastic cups. We had crystal cups or glass cups. And they were like all 16 ounces, I think, because I remember as a 12-year-old, and we would come up to the front, and we had a table, and they would always get the oldest and slowest speaking person to lead the prayer, and I would be a 12-year-old, and I would be holding those trays, and like sometimes if you were in the right position, you had to hold two, and my arms, I would sit there, and they were praying, and I know this is, you're supposed to close your eyes and think, but I was thinking, please God, don't let me drop these trays, and they would, I watched them slowly start tilting down, and tilting down. It's like, you gotta hurry it up, Mr. Ira. You've got to finish this thing up. But that's the way, that's the communion that we grew up, and now we do it a little differently, especially since COVID. We've got, we get it together and we get to all take it together. So there's benefits to that. But this practice, essentially in churches of Christ and in other Christian denominations across the world, will take the Lord's Supper every Sunday. Some take it less often. Some take it once a month or once a quarter or something along those lines. But we take it every Sunday. We share these emblems of the bread and the fruit of the vine, and we commemorate the life and death and burial and resurrection of our Lord Jesus Christ. So the question I just want to ask is, what is what we do every Sunday? What does it have to do with what Jesus did in that upper room? How is it related what we do here on Sundays and what Jesus did in the upper room as we're reading through and studying through the Gospel of Mark? How are those things related? What does one have to do with the other? What was Jesus accomplishing in his meal, and what are we accomplishing in our remembrance? So does what we do matter, or is it just a symbolic gesture? I mean, what's going on here? What are we accomplishing here when we gather around this table and take this bread and take this cup? So in the Gospel of Mark, we're in chapter 14, if you want to be flipping over there, but it's time for the Passover meal. Jesus has come, brought his followers into Jerusalem, and it's time for the Passover meal, and they're in the Jerusalem area. Jesus sends two of his disciples into the city to meet a man, and it feels like it's been prearranged, that Jesus has prearranged for this man to provide them a space to take the Passover meal. Now, what we need to know is the Passover, thousands and thousands and thousands of extra people come into the city. There's no Super 8, there's no sleep in. You've got to find space where you can get space. And if you're going to be taking in a big meal, you have to have a space to do that together. You can't just throw that together under a tree. So it seems that Jesus has made arrangements, or somebody in Jesus' party has made arrangements for them to partake of the Passover. The meal traditionally is supposed to be eaten inside of the city of Jerusalem. So space would have been at a premium. And it all goes just, Jesus sends them out, and it all goes just like Jesus told them it would go, and they find the man, then they find the house, and then they find the room that has been prepared for them. Now, in the usual Passover meal, it's led, each meal is led by the father of the house, right? They're the spiritual leader of their home, so the father of the house would do that. But in this case, with Jesus and his disciples, right, they're not a literal physical family. So who's going to lead the Passover meal? Well, it's obviously Jesus. Clearly, Jesus serves as the host for this meal. So in a very real sense, when they gather together to take the Passover, it is the table of the Lord. I mean, that's what they are gathered around, the table of the Lord. These disciples have been invited to be a part of Jesus' family in eating this sacred meal together. The Passover is what you celebrate with your family. And Jesus has said to his disciples, you are part of my family. Now, traditionally at the Passover, there would be multiple courses of vegetables and bread. There would be the sacrificial lamb. There would be generally four cups of wine that would accompany this meal, four ceremonial cups of wine anyway. So these are likely the things that Jesus is telling the disciples when he sends them ahead. He's like, you got to get these things ready. You got to have the vegetables, got to have the lamb, got to have the wine, got to have the space, right? All this has to be ready. This is not just show up buffet style. So the Passover is supposed to be a time of remembrance. Jesus and his disciples are gathered around this table. What are they supposed to be remembering? What's Jesus remembering? Well, that's one of the things that's pretty different. Because when we gather here and we take the bread and the cup, we're remembering Jesus, traditionally. But they're gathering for the Passover meal, so they're not remembering Jesus. Jesus is sitting right there. So they're remembering, what has God done to rescue us from slavery? What has God done to bring us up out of Egyptian slavery and deliver us into the land of promise? That's what they are remembering, how God has delivered them. So everybody who's celebrating the Passover, that's what they're going to be thinking about. It was a time to remember being brought out of Egyptian bondage. It was a time for them to remember how God took this ragtag group of slaves and made them into his people, forging a covenant with them at Mount Sinai. So you're gathered around the table, you're having these discussions, you're remembering these things, you're eating the vegetables, and then at some point in the meal, the father of the household, the host of the dinner, the head of the table, would tell the story. The father would tell the mighty deeds of God, what God has done, what God's acts of deliverance, what God's faithfulness to his people looks like. And finally, they're ready and they're all assembled. Jesus' disciples, they're in that upper room. And this is when they begin their evening meal. And this is what Mark says beginning in verse 17. When evening came, Jesus arrived with the 12. And while they were reclining at the table eating, he said, "Truly, I tell you, one of you will betray me, one who's eating with me." And they were saddened. And one by one, they said to him, "Surely you don't mean me." "It is one of the 12," he replied, "one who dips bread into the bowl with me. The Son of Man will go just as it is written about him. But woe to that man who betrays the Son of Man. It would be better for him if he had not been born." So Jesus is saying, as they're gathered for this meal, this family meal, he is saying, and he's been telling them all along, "Look, I'm going to be betrayed. It's going to be betrayed to the religious leaders, and it's going to go horribly. It's going to go like you'd imagine. I'm going to die." But they don't know who's going to do that, right? And now Jesus reveals to them, it's not just somebody. It's not, you know, the guy whose house we're at. It's not somebody who's been listening for a couple of days. It's going to be one of you who betrays me. And they're like, "No, surely not me." And Jesus says, "Yeah, somebody who dips their bread into the same bowl as me." Now, in the movies or the TV show, if you ever seen a recreation of the scene, it's always that moment, like Jesus is reaching to dip his bread and Judas is like not paying attention and they just happen to dip their bread at the same time. They're like, "Oh no, we figured out who it is," right? That's the way it goes in the movies and TV show. That's not what Jesus is saying, like there's going to be some super secret magical moment that we happen to put our bread in the bowl at the same time. No, what he's saying is someone who's one of you that we sit around and we share a meal together in the most intimate of settings. This is not like we happen to be eating at the Golden Corral at the same time. This is family style around a table. We're all dipping our bread in the same bowl. All of you put your bread in the same bowl as me. You're the closest disciples I have. You're the ones who know me best, the ones who love me most. It's going to be one of you who dips his bread in the bowl at the same time as me. Or dips his bread in the same bowl I dip my bread in. Someone who's very close to me. So, for the first time, we know that it's not somebody else out there. It's one of them. It is one of them. And this famous painting, by the way, shock and outrage. The moment that this painting is supposed to be capturing is right after Jesus says that. He says, "It's one of you 12," and they're all looking around like, "Could it be me? I can't believe he said that. Who could it be? What's going on? Do you think it's so-and-so? Do you think it's so-and-so?" Shock and outrage. How could it be one of us? We're the ones who know and love Jesus best. So in Eastern culture, when you share a table, it's with your family, right? To put a knife in the back of your dinner host is the most repulsive thing you can do. You just don't do that. You might betray other people, and that's bad. Nobody's excusing it. But to betray your dinner host, And this painting of Da Vinci portrays the reaction that each apostle might give to this news with various degrees of, you know, anger and outrage. Later, we're going to learn that Peter specifically, one of the closest, Peter specifically, he's going to deny Christ three times, and that all of the disciples, except for John, are going to run away. Right? They're all going to abandon Jesus in his hour of greatest need. The time he wants their support the most is when they get it, he gets it the least. They're all going to turn and run. We have this tendency in TVs and movie and in our imaginations, we think about Jesus like almost emotionless. Like he's kind of such a spiritual dude, and he's pale and he's skinny, and he talks without emotion, and it's just almost ethereal. Like he's not a regular human being. But to be abandoned by your closest friends? Jesus was fully human. Clearly that hurts him. In Gethsemane, when he knows this is about to happen, he's like, please, you guys come with me and stay up with me and pray with me. And then they fall asleep on him. He's like, come on, I need you. I want your closeness and nearness, just some support. And of course, they fall back asleep again. They abandon him in his hour of greatest need. Now, I remember when I first became a Christian, and maybe you remember when you first became a Christian too. Do you remember thinking and feeling like, oh, now that I'm a Christian, I am never going to do anything wrong again? Do you remember that? You remember that feeling like, oh, I'm never going to go back and say these things or think these things or do those things. Now that I'm a follower of Jesus, it is the straight and narrow for me, and I have got it down, and I'm just going to just follow Jesus. I remember feeling that way and thinking that way. Maybe you remember it too. When you come up out of that water, all clean and new and certain that you're always going to do the right thing, that you're never going to turn your back on Jesus, that you would never betray him or abandon him. And I also vividly remember that moment of just shame and guilt when I realized what I had said or what I had done, that in some way I had betrayed Jesus too. I mean, how could I ever show my face to Jesus when he knows what I've done and I know what I've done? It's just too shameful, too embarrassing. I mean, Jesus knows exactly what I did. Jesus watched over me as I turned my back on him. So how could Jesus ever want to associate with me again? I mean, that's the worst. It would be like if my wife caught me on a date with another woman. I would be so embarrassed. I was like, how could I go home now? It would just feel so shameful, right? So why would Jesus want anything to do with me? And while they were eating, Jesus took bread. And when he'd given thanks, he broke it and he gave it to his disciples saying, take and eat. This is my body. And then he took a cup. And when he had given thanks, he gave it to them and they all drank from it. This is my blood of the covenant, which is poured out for many, he said. Truly I tell you, I will not drink again from the fruit of the vine until that day when I drink it new in the kingdom of God. It's kind of something, isn't it? Jesus knows these 12. He knows Peter, Andrew, James, and John, all the way down to Judas. He knows all his friends are going to abandon and betray him. And he still chose to share a meal with them. He knows they're not what they appear to be. He knows they're not the good guys. One of the most shocking stories we see woven into the table is this story of abandonment and rejection and redemption. And far from being surprised, this doesn't take Jesus off guard. He knows it. He knows exactly what kind of people are seated at the table with him. He sees them for who they are. He sees their flaws. He knows their weaknesses. He understands that none of them are going to get it right. And yet, he chooses to not only eat with them, but to offer them his body and to pour out his blood. That's the beauty of the table. At the Passover meal with his disciples, directly before his death and his burial and his resurrection, Jesus changes the meaning This meal that millions of people have eaten for hundreds of years, Jesus changes the meaning of that meal. He gives it new meaning. It's been a reminder of their escape from slavery in Egypt. And Jesus is reminding them, he's teaching them that Jesus himself is going to make a sacrifice that also frees them from slavery, the slavery of sin. The meal has always pointed backward, but now it's going to point both backward and forward. Jesus' blood, of course, means his sacrificial death, right? His blood's going to be poured out. But his body, that means his physical presence, his abiding presence with them. And the table itself, the fact that you're doing this at a meal, the table itself is a foretaste of the coming kingdom of God, when all of God's children throughout all of the ages are gathered at God's table. When we're all seated around the same table and all the way back, and Abraham and Sarah and David and Moses and Elijah and Elisha and Jesus, and everybody's gathered at his table. Everybody's going to be gathered at his table. It's going to be like we did, my family, because we're a little spread out and we're going all over the place this week. We had Thanksgiving yesterday, and it was with my parents and with my brother and his family and everybody except for my daughter. And we got to be on that side of the family, got to be together at this one table. And so we were like, oh, we're missing my one daughter. She's overseas right now. And so we put up a picture of her, and then we included her in our meal, even though she wasn't there. And she's like, you know, was there in spirit. That's what she says. And I said, you know, well, we welcome your spirit. We'd rather have your body, but we'll take your spirit as well. And however we can get you, even though you're far distant. And sometimes I think we approach the table of the Lord like, you know, I can't really be there, but I'm there in spirit. And God says, that's not enough. One day, we're going to have this table, and everybody from everywhere, from all generations, no matter how far you've come, no matter what your background, what you've done, no matter how distant you may be, one day there's no going to be gathered in spirit. There's going to be gathered all together. And this morning, each one of us, no matter how flawed and broken we are, and despite our stupid, selfish betrayals, which we are prone to, we are invited to the table of the Lord. This communal meal that we share with a Christ, it has a seat with your name on it. There's a little placard set in front of your plate that has got your name, and this seat is reserved for you. And yes, I know what you've done, and that's okay, but you're still coming to my table because you're family. That is the table. That is the feast. And we eat it in memory of what Christ has done, and we also eat it in the hope of the promise of what's to come. We remember the Last Supper, and we look forward to the First Supper, that first one when we gather together at the end of time. That is this communal table. And this morning, we're going to be gathered together here shortly to do just that.